Today is Sunday, January 6th, 2008. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I'm an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Program. Today, I'm interviewing Norma Berkowitz, Clinical Assistant Professor Emeritus in the UW-Madison School of Social Work. Norma Berkowitz began her career at Wisconsin in 1967 and retired in 1993. She is the founder and current president of Friends of Chernobyl Centers United States, or FOCUS. We'll learn more about FOCUS in the interview. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to start the interview by asking you to talk about your early life, where and when you were born, talk about your family, your early schooling, any people that influenced you in your career.
Okay, well, I can tell you where I was born, in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, which is about 32 miles from Pittsburgh. So I grew up in basically a coal mining, steel kind of city. It was a small town.
What year was that?
1929. And in terms of my family background, my grandparents came from Scotland and Wales on both my mother and father's side. And we had a small family. It was my mother and dad, and I had a sister who was killed in an automobile accident with her three children in the 1950s. And my my mother had a sister, and my father had two sisters. Neither of my father's sisters had any children. And so I was probably spoiled.
What did your father do?
My father was, my grandfather had a dry goods store in this small town in which we lived. And when he died, my father ran the store, but they lost it during the Depression. So my father went into sales, and he did life insurance and a bunch of other things. And finally ended up working for a company that did, that made gasoline pumps. And eventually, my dad became a distributor for them.
Did he have to travel then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had an eastern United States territory. My mother did not have a career. My father only had a grade school education. My mother had a kind of a secretarial kind of, very brief, and she had a problem with her back that kept her pretty not as as easy to get around as she would have liked. Mm-hmm. But she was a so she was always a homebody. But she was very musical, and she was a soloist in many of the churches and community functions, and she belonged to a quartet, a women's quartet, and I can still see them in their taffeta printed gowns, you know. So I also had a very musical family. And one of my dad's sisters was the person of the world in the family. And she started a college career but gave it up and then went into secretarial work and business work and eventually lived in Chicago and New York City.
Oh.
And then came back to a hometown and as a secretary for a chief executive of a steel firm. But she's the one who got me interested in the world and in music and theater. And
Were you able to visit her in Chicago?
No, that was when I was young.
Oh,
oh, once I remember we went to the World's Fair. When she was there, in 49. So I remember that. But when she came back to Beaver Falls, she was an opera buff. And every Saturday afternoon, there was no excuses, I went to her place. And we listened to the Metropolitan Opera, and we had the librettos right in front of us, and most of them she had already seen, and she'd say, now here's Aida, and here's where they actually bring an elephant on the stage. So it made it very real.
Oh, I'm sure. What about your, now, this was a small town.
Yeah, about 14, 16,000 at the time.
Oh, okay, well, that's not big.
No, it's guess not it's
big. Right,
yeah.
What was the, you went to public school?
Oh, yeah.
Was it a good school system?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think so. My high school. Yeah, I would say yes. It was very good. I almost flunked Latin, but the rest of my, I was good enough to get in the National Honor Society, but I nearly flunked Latin.
Now, was that just because you weren't interested and didn't study, or you?
I just didn't get it.
Okay.
And we had a teacher that was so severe and so critical, nobody wanted to open their mouth. You know, so you didn't.
I see.
But and I was never very good at math either. But I had a great time in school. I'm very active.
Were you involved in music in school, or?
I played the piano, not very well, but well enough to play for the chorus, and I was a member of the Usher's Club at the high school, and we got to usher for all of the concerts that came to the city. They all played. We only had one concert hall, and it was in the high school. And if you were a good student and you were well-liked, you got elected to the Usher's Club. It was all girls. And then you got into the concerts for free. And that was a time when that would be in the 40s, late 40s, when a lot of small towns were bringing, there was some sort of a program where they could bring nationally known artists to small communities. So that's how I got a lot more music education.
Now you were fairly close to Pittsburgh, where there were cultural
and I had a girlfriend available? That also loved music, and so did her mother, and I still remember going to my first opera at the Pittsburgh what's the name of the, not Rotary Club,
Lions?
The Mason, the Masonic Temple,
right.
in Pittsburgh was the biggest place, had the biggest, and I remember going to my first opera there and sitting up in peanut heaven. And once in a while we'd get to go to the opera that way. And I was in high school when I went to the first one. So music's always been a part of my life.
Did you go to college then right after high school?
Mm-hmm.
And did you know when you were in high school that that was what you were going to do?
I thought so.
And your parents supported that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Half a block from our house was Geneva College. And Geneva College was a liberal arts college, very small, and run by the Reformed Presbyterian Church, the Covenanters. And of course, I could live at home, and so the cost wasn't too great. But I used to get teased, you roll out of bed and into your class. I was so close.
Well, how big a student body was it?
600 maybe at the most.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started out, I wanted to be an anthropologist or an archaeologist. And then I quickly learned that there was no future in that unless you got a PhD. And then if you got a PhD, there still wasn't much of a future. So I decided to major in sociology. And I worked my way through 2 years there. And then I decided I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I quit.
And then what?
Well, I got a job on one of the local newspapers and I wrote obituaries. It was a small town, even smaller than Beaver Falls. So I did that for a while I
was that a full-time job?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, dear. I mean, I did proofreading. No, I mean, you know, I just got the whole spiel. And it was while I was trying to decide. You know, I mean, I didn't want to keep on going to college not knowing what I wanted to do. And sociology was fine, but I didn't want to, again, you know, what do you do with a sociology major without a PhD? I figured, this isn't right. Oh, at one point I wanted to be a nurse. And my parents said, what do you want to do that for? You want to carry bedpans the rest of your life? And I said, no, I don't want to do that.
They didn't try to influence you in a particular, if they didn't like the idea,
they didn't like the nursing idea. But they didn't put pressure on me to do this or do that or go here or go there.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was working at the that year off college or year and a half, whatever it was, we were close enough to Pittsburgh and the trains ran often enough. I took a couple of courses at University of Pittsburgh on criminology and something else, I forget. But then I decided I really wanted to go and settle down to something. And there was a wonderful woman that lived in a rental apartment of my aunt's, and she was a social worker. And one day she said, you know, I have to take this mentally retarded child to the state hospital, and I don't want to do it by myself. Would you go along? So I said, sure. And, of course, we had plenty of time to talk on the way, and I got into this institution, which I never would have gotten into alone. And she talked a lot about what she did as a social worker. And I thought, oh, well, that sounds pretty good. And then maybe I could, and I knew social workers worked in hospitals. So I thought, well, you know, I don't want to be there as a nurse, but maybe as a social worker. So I decided to go finish my education, college education, sort of getting ready to be a social worker. And I decided to go to Penn State. So I spent my last 2 years at Penn State. And you asked if my parents encouraged me. They did. And it wasn't easy for them. They didn't have a whole lot of money. By the way, my sister decided to be a nurse.
Oh,
really? She was a nurse. I remember every time I wrote a check for $10, I had to call my dad and say, I just wrote a check for $10. Is there enough money in the bank to cover it? So it was tight.
Yeah.
But
did you work while you were in school? Or?
I was no, but I was, you mean at Penn State?
Yeah, at Penn State.
No. Because of the nature of the town and so on, it wasn't a good place where you could work and go to school. At that point, now you can because it's a big area, kind of populated area. But I became, what did they call them? At the dormitory, a counselor.
Oh, yeah.
At the dormitory, and I got free housing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was better than having a job.
Oh, sure.
So that's how that went.
Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy your 2 years at Penn State?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I got involved in, when I was at Geneva College, I also got involved in drama. And so when I went to Penn State, I got involved in a theater club there. And what else did I do?
Did you continue the music?
No, just more as an observer, not as a participant.
And what about the education, your education? Were your classes?
They were good. They didn't have an undergraduate degree in social work in those times. But I had a good instructor who knew what I wanted to do, and he said, well, you know, they're over about an hour and a half bus ride from here, across the mountains, is the only institution for mentally retarded women of childbearing age in the whole country. So if you really want to get some social work experience, I'll give you independent credit. And if we can arrange for you to go there. That's what we did.
So what did you do, spend a semester?
I don't know if it was a semester or a whole year, but trudging over cross campus to the bus, hopping on the bus over the mountains, da 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 da. And that was my first experience with the mentally handicapped.
Talk about it. What was it? And you still wanted to be a social worker, or even more? Oh, you wanted to be a social worker.
Yeah. And so I completed my bachelor's degree with a sociology and psychology majors, or major and minor. I pretty much decided that I wanted to be a surgeon. But then I went back to my medical thinking. I thought, well, I could be, you know, this is fine. I could be a medical social. Well, I got out and found out you couldn't be a medical social worker without a master's degree.
Oh, okay.
That was a blow.
Mm-hmm. Now, was it, you weren't opposed to doing that. It's just that you wanted to get out and work. Is that it, or?
You mean opposed to what?
Well, it was a blow that you were going to have a master's degree.
Yeah, because I had no way to get a master's
degree.
Okay,
you know,
I mean,
right.
You know, it was, my sister was in nursing school, and they were supporting her, and, you know, there were very limited resources. And I didn't put any pressure on them, say, oh, thanks for the bachelor's degree, but how about... So I ended up getting a job as a caseworker in a welfare department up near the New York border, up in Montrose, Pennsylvania. It's not too far from the New York border.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked up there for a year and a half. 2 years, maybe. That was a different experience, too.
In what way? What were the things you had to do?
Well, the most vibrant memory I have was that I was a junior visitor, because I wasn't qualified quite as a social worker. And one of the things I had to do was go out and make calls on people pre-adoption who were taking care of kids who were pending adoption. So that wasn't, and just come back and say, okay, everything looks okay or not. Well, I went, and I had a relationship with this family. We had placed a newborn there, and plans were moving ahead for the adoption, and they had just heard that they were going to have to take the baby to the office to meet potentially adoptive parents. Well, the farmer came out with his shotgun. Get away from here. You know, I didn't argue.
I guess not.
I left and called quick to the office, and they had to call the police and come. So that's the most vivid memory I have that time. And it was an interesting experience to live in such an small agricultural area away from any kind of academic or environment or anything. It was kind of a lonely time, but it was okay. And then my college boyfriend called and came up and wanted to get married, and I said, okay. So that ended that experience.
So then where did you go?
Penn State, at State College, Penn State.
Okay, you went back there.
Yeah, he got a job as a field representative for the National Holstein Association. He got his degree at Penn State. That's where I met him,
mm-hmm.
And he was an ag major, and he'd grown up on a farm, and so this was a good match,
mm-hmm.
for him, and he could open up his office anywhere he wanted, and State College is right in the center of the state, so it was no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you didn't have to go across state every time you needed to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm. So did you work then?
Yeah, I worked as the office secretary.
Oh.
And this was a membership organization. I learned a lot.
Oh, really?
It was a membership organization, and they did teaching and training, held annual meetings and blah, 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 you know,
mm-hmm.
that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran the office out of our home.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first kind of office experience. It went pretty well.
Mm-hmm. For, and how long did you do that?
Well, let's see, by this time it must have been 51. We were married in 51. So I did that till about 55 or something like that. Then we came out to into Wisconsin.
And was that his job that brought him to
Minnesota? He got a new job.
Okay.
He became a sales manager for National Agricultural Supply Company, NASCO, which is headquartered in Fort Atkinson.
So was that, in your mind, was that a positive move? Were you excited about that?
Yeah, I think so. Although it meant being farther from home. But it was a new adventure and a new part of the world. And I'd been out here to one of the national conferences,
yeah.
with him. So it wasn't like going to someplace I'd never been before.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a chance to come out here before and see and talk to people before he accepted the job.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was okay.
Mm-hmm. And when you got here, how long did you know that there was a school of social work here?
No, I wasn't even thinking about that. I had two kids by this time.
Uh-huh.
And that was the center of life.
So did you not work out of the home for a while when you
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I didn't.
And then what?
Well, I think one of the things that was a big thing was when my sister was killed in the automobile accident. Three of her kids. And one, the only one that lit, her husband was out of the car, so he survived. But and the oldest child survived, but with severe brain damage. And that was tough on absolutely everybody.
Oh, I can't imagine.
And that was a hard time.
Yeah.
And that's when the strains in my marriage began to really show. And we separated. And I went back to Pennsylvania. Then we got together, and I came back here. And then we finally got a divorce.
But you stayed here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time I could see the handwriting on the wall, and by that time I knew there was a school of social work here.
Ah.
And I eventually, after we broke up, got a job in the social work in the welfare department in Jefferson County. And then that's when I started to take courses, not so much on campus, but because those were all during the day.
Mm-hmm.
But I took courses in Janesville, a couple courses in Janesville, night courses.
So they were sponsored
by the school of social work.
Oh, okay. So. I didn't know that they did that.
Well, they did then.
Yeah, but not very many departments did that in those days,
no,
right?
No. And I had a really good instructor, and it was on, and I, Jack Sternback, I don't know if you've ever run across him, but he was good, very good. So that's how I ended up at the University of Wisconsin.
So you were a student then, but, and you were, when did you get, did you then eventually start working for the school before
well,
you got
no,
your degree?
No, okay. No, I continued to work in Jefferson County, and I took these couple of courses.
Now, what were you doing in Jefferson
County? I was working as a caseworker in the public welfare department.
Were there a lot of cases in Jefferson County?
Oh, yes.
Really?
It's a poor, relatively poor agricultural community. There was some industry there. The big one is the sausage people.
Oh, Jones? No.
No, I forget what it is. And it will take me too long to
That's
remember.
Okay.
But, and there's another dairy kind of manufacturing plant there that's big. But it was a good place to raise my kids.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it was. The schools were pretty good. And we lived two blocks from the elementary school, and so
it, in which town did you live?
Fort Atkinson.
In Fort Atkinson.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I continued to work. After we separated, I continued to work for a while, but I was always finagling how to keep my finger in the academic pie so I could get my degree. And the school was wonderful to me in that we had to do a field placement. You know, and that's a huge thing. I mean, it's half time.
Mm.
Well, how was I going to work full time down there and do half time up here?
Yeah.
No way. But they said, well, there's a mental health clinic in Jefferson, and it's run by a certified psychologist, and there's psychiatric consultation there. So we'll let you make out your own schedule with them, and we'll give you credit for it. So they were, I mean, they really, really were very, very good. Without the flexibility that they offered me, I would never, ever have made it.
And was that in the 60s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I was able to complete 1 year of my field placement down there. That was a really big thing. And then I had the courses, night courses that I had taken. And it got to the point where I just, for the second year, you just have to have full, not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, I could see if you're ever going to get through this, you're going to have a full. You're going to have to be free to do for a year.
Uh-huh.
So, we moved. I moved my kids from Fort Atkinson to Madison, and Middleton rather.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked out just fine. The Middleton schools were fine. They had a good time.
Mm-hmm.
We still have friends they made there. And I could devote myself to what I needed to do.
So you went to school full time then for,
mm-hmm. For a year.
For a year.
Yeah.
You remember any particular faculty members that were influential?
Sure. Yeah. Ray Munns, who was later the head of, oh, well, he was the head of the school then. And I was not a policy person. I mean, I knew they were, you had to know it, you know. But Ray was a politician, and he taught policy. But he did it in the most creative way, because he turned our classroom into the legislature.
Huh.
And we each were assigned roles, and he gave us the names of real persons.
Oh my, I think that would be fun.
And so, and that's the way he ran the course, and he was a great guy, a wonderful human being. And the other person was very important to me, was not a tenured faculty person, a clinical faculty person named Imogene Higby. And she taught the practice courses. And she was absolutely phenomenal. And very committed to real life teaching and real life relationships in the process of teaching. So she stands out. And then the other two were Ann Minahan and Alan Pincus. And Ann didn't have a PhD, but she was a member of the tenured faculty. Mm-hmm. And she and Alan Pincus came out with an approach to social work practice called the systems approach. And it was at the time in the wider world, people were talking about systems and da 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 da, and I forget the name of the guy who came up with systems theory, but anyhow, that was their model for teaching and social work practice, and that was Imogene's model for social work practice, and that was me. I never wanted to be a psychotherapist. I was always looking for how one thing related to another, and if you had a social work client, it's you need to know who's involved in their lives, what agencies are involved, what they're getting from this or that or whatever, you know. It's mm-hmm. I never wanted to be a psychotherapist, because what the psychotherapist does is look inside your head. Mm-hmm. Well, you can have anything going on inside your head, and it may or may not help you. Mm-hmm. So that was not for me. So this approach, it seemed to be who I was and the way I was living my life, and that made it more meaningful.
Now, do you know, was that unique to this social school?
Yes.
It was.
It was unique to this social work school. And it was eventually picked up all over the country. Some schools, because the model for social work education was a casework group or community organization. And you, in most schools of social work, you were on that track or that track or that track.
Okay.
And this school of social work never did that.
I get it.
It still doesn't, thank God. Hmm. You can still come up and you're not a clinical social worker or a psychotherapist, you're not a group worker, you're not a blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
You are a social worker. And you look at the contact, and you know, there's a whole bunch of that stuff. But that was me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I saw the world, and it was so wonderful to come and see that this was okay. This was somebody who was a lot brighter and a lot older and a lot more experienced than I was said, this is, you know, this is the way to see the world.
Yeah.
And and it was just right for me and people. So I got my master's degree in 67, I think. I don't remember. But it was, the other thing I wanted to say was, oh, I was always, and I read some of my stuff before you came, I was always prevention. You know, it's all right if you have to do something to help people once something has happened, that's good. But if you can prevent what has happened to them from happening to them, that's even better. And I still live by that, and I still work in that way. And I, so I worked with the guy in the psychiatry department, Bowman, and he was writing about prevention and basic, you know, prevention approaches to not disease prevention, but mm-hmm. social prevention.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I am right now. I am still engaged in Wisconsin Cares, headed by Jack Westman, and the psychiatric, retired from psychiatry. And this is the whole thing that we're still doing.
Well, I want to hear more about that, but I want to hear how you got there, because you got your degree in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
And did you immediately...
I joined the faculty.
You did.
That was the time when the federal government was pouring money into social work education, because things were in such bad shape and they needed people. And so they were pouring money into schools of social work, and our schools of social work got it. And I applied to the Division of Mental Hygiene. They had their hands on the money. So I applied to them for financial support, and because I wasn't getting enough child support to do all this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a stipend, and the stipend came from the federal government through the State Division of Mental Hygiene to the School of Social Work. And then between the school and the Division of Mental Hygiene, they decided who would get these stipends. And so I got one.
Mm-hmm.
And have you heard of Martin Loeb? Oh, you must have heard of Martin Loeb.
But why?
He was the head of the School of Social Work.
Okay.
A charismatic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have heard of him. Yes. Yep.
To put it mildly charismatic.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he said... given all the experience that I had had and as I had done so well, he said, we just got money for a position. It's not a faculty position, and you can't be a faculty member the first year. But if you do okay, then I can give you the faculty position. So it was a clinical... non-tenured, I don't remember what they called us, even. We weren't called anything. We were just there. So I worked the first year after grad school, I worked with Harry Weissman in the Child Development Clinic at the old University Hospital down here. And actually that's where I met Len's wife and him.
Uh-huh.
So I worked for a year with Harry Weissman as a social worker in the Child Development Clinic, but with the understanding that if all went well, Martin said, you'll have a non-tenured field instructor, that's what they call,
right.
Field instructor,
right. Okay.
Position with us. And you're not on the tenure track, and it's not clear that the funding will last forever, but you can start. So that's how I got started. And
so what do you do? What did you do as a field worker?
As a field instructor in the School of Social Work, you have to take 2 1-year half-time field placements.
You know, like you did at the mental health arm.
That's
right,
it.
Right.
So I had students who came to the clinic on a regular basis that I supervised. And then the school set up a kind of a way for because there were other positions within the school funded this way, and they were called field instructors. And we didn't teach in the classroom, but we were the ones that supposed to teach people the skills that they needed to be a social worker. And most of us also felt we had to relate that to what they were learning in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I started out, as a field instructor. And then I was with the, and I was placed at the Weissman Center. Once the Weissman Center opened up and so on, and I had a variety of experiences there. But
talk about some of them.
Well, there was as. Oh, well, let me just go back and say one more thing, because people kept saying to me, Norma, if anybody should go on for a PhD, you should. I said, you don't know me very well.
Well, I was going to ask that question too, but...
I am not interested. I don't want to... I don't see the world that way. Mm-hmm. I'm not good at statistics. I want to be in a people world. And at that point, I didn't have any big conceptions about being a teacher. I never wanted to be a teacher either. Mm-hmm. So here I was sort of teaching. Excuse me, I have to get a PhD. It was the best decision I ever made. So I just continued as a field instructor.
Well, you were talking about the Weissman Center, and you had various experiences.
Yeah, and the first experience was as a field instructor within the Weissman Center, and had a diagnostic and treatment unit, and kids who were having developmental problems in their families from anywhere in the state could call up and ask to be seen by the interdisciplinary team at this diagnostic and treatment unit. And this unit was a teaching unit for all the disciplines who came there. And it was the most exciting thing. Every day I went to work, I learned from everybody. Mm. Because we had teaching, nursing, speech and language, neurology, psychology, you know, all of these disciplines. And we would all be working on the same case. You would come together to say, okay, we've all gathered the information that we want now, you know, before they came in.
Sure.
And you'd get that was one of the things we had to do. We had to get their school reports, the doctor's report, blah, blah, blah. And then we all had that information. And then we planned what we were going to do in terms of an evaluation of this. And then when they came in, we all did our evaluation. Then we had and we all got together, including the parents, and we said, this is what psychiatry found, this is what this recommends, and then we'd work with the parents and we'd bring it all together. Now that was utopia.
Absolutely.
And there is no place in the country today where you could go and find that kind of experience. It was, and it isn't even happening at the Weissman Center anymore.
That's
Everything's
sad.
Too fragmented, and the disciplines say we have to teach our own, blah, 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 you know.
Yeah.
So it was an absolutely, and it so fit with my perception of the world, that people are not just this or just that or just this situation or that situation.
Yeah, this whole system.
It's the whole system. Yeah. And what happens in the school has relevance for what happens when you go to the doctors. And when you go to the doctors, that has something to say about what's going on in the family. And when the family gets mad at the doctor, you know,
mm-hmm.
that whole thing. So that was wonderful.
Sounds like it.
And
but were you able to do that not throughout your career, right?
No, that's where I started. And then they promoted me.
Oh, dear.
And I became the coordinator for all the training. I was head of the interdisciplinary training committee. So I did that.
Did you enjoy that?
Oh yeah,
good.
Very much. But then I don't know where we are 7-6 years out of grad school, and even with all that excitement, it was. I was beginning to feel limited. And thinking about, well, do I want to, you have a choice. You want to stay in this field. I mean, that's a wonderful part about social work. You can work with this client group. If you get disgusted with that, you can, you know, you don't want to work with the mentally ill anymore. Okay, get a job working with the aging, blah, blah, blah. You know, so I was happy, but I was thinking there's more out there. And Len's wife, Nettie, was working with me. I mean, we were all at the Waitsmith Center. And I started telling her, well, I don't know, I'm getting sort of bored with this. And she said, well, Len and I are going to Oxford next year. Why did you think about going to England? I said, yes, sure. Just boom. She said, no, I'm serious. Write up your resume, give it to Len. He knows a couple of people over in Oxford that are high up in the social work education over there. And I put it off, and she said, come on. So I did it, and he mailed it off to Oxford. And what happened was the woman wrote back, and she said, well, I don't think Mrs. Nesbitt is qualified for an Oxford position, but my very best friend is head of the Council on Social Work Education in the United Kingdom. And I happen to know that they have a proposal pending for somebody who would have expertise in mental retardation. And if they get that position, maybe your friend would like to apply. Well, you're gonna be amazed at this. So I'm working with a guy by Harvey Stevens, who was another big guy at Waisman Center and administration and head of mental retardation internationally. And there was going to be an international conference in Holland. And he said, Norma, we'll pay your way if you want to go. Oh, I'll go. I have to think, oh my God, did I really do this? I said, okay, I'm going to be in Holland. Why don't I drop over to London? And I did. I wrote to the woman who was head of the social work. I had already sent in my resume and said, I understand that you may be looking for somebody, and here's my resume, da, da, da. So I wrote and I said, I sort of said, I'm going to be in the neighborhood and I'd be glad to drop in for a job interview. And my God, that's what I did. And they said, well, we don't have the funding for this yet. But I walked out of there knowing if they got the funding for that position, I was going to get it. And I did. So I asked for a leave of absence here. Oh, and then what was I doing? But yeah, that's right. And I asked for a leave of absence here, and then I went to London.
So were your children?
They were in college.
Now. Okay.
Yeah, they were both in college.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I said to my former husband, "Okay, it's your turn," and he did.
Mm-hmm. So you went to London.
I went to London.
What was that experience like?
It was fascinating. And I mean, I really was impressed by the fact that we speak the same language, but it doesn't mean the same thing. Professionally, they didn't have a formal social work education classes in the university. This Council on Social Work Education was in charge of all of they didn't have a degree in social work education. You took courses at the university after you got your degree. It was called the Certificate Qualification in Social Work. So it was, you got your your degree, and then you had this kind of contributed to your degree, and you could call yourself a social worker. But it wasn't like having a bachelor's degree in social work.
I'm just going to
be in social work. So this council had to approve all of those courses. That was one of the things that they did. And that was part of my job. And then they had another training course for nurses who were going to work in mental retardation facilities. So it was a very different kind of educational process. Mm-hmm. And of course, learning that university system is so different from ours. It took a while to get used to that, but I had very good coworkers, and I think they were as amazed at me as I was at them. The words, she dropped from outer space. But it was an interesting time. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
How long did you stay in that position?
About two years, and by that time, Len was courting me.
Uh-huh.
And coaxed me back.
And you still had your leave of absence, so you.
Well, yeah, I said I wrote and said I'm not coming back at the end of this. You know, I mean, I don't know what my future is. Well, Raymond's running back and said, your future is here. And we'll extend your leave until you decide what you want to do. I mean, they were wonderful to me. Because I didn't know what, I mean, I assumed I was coming back because Len was certainly going to come back. And if I were going to come with him, yeah, I better go. So I don't know, I guess I was here almost two years. But it was interesting. The cultural differences, and the thing that just upset me the most was, I'm a fairly good writer, I thought, not over there. I would get my position papers and my reports back, redlined. We don't use active voice here, passive voice, you know, things like that. And the other thing, that relationships were different, because I was living in London, and London is a big, you know, it's a metropolitan. I'd never lived in a place like that. But the people I worked with were very, very good. Things were changing for their profession. It was a wonderful experience. And I still have my contacts there, and we still go back. And one of my best friends was one of my bosses. And it was interesting, and it brought me closer to Europe, mm-hmm. that, which is important for further development. In terms of the international things, one of the things I did when I was only that was when I came back, and I'm not back yet. So
okay, well now you're back.
They wanted me to come back to the Weissman Center, and I did for a while, but I don't know, a year, but it was a 12-month appointment, mm-hmm. and Len was on a 9-month, and, we would have rather had the time together. So I went to Martin Loeb, who was a director by then, and I said, I think it was Martin, maybe it was still Ray. And I said, I don't want to, I would like to stay with the school, but I don't want to stay in this position. And I said, okay, how would you like to be the director of field education? That's an assistant director's position. Oh, okay. Oh, and in the meantime, no, the first thing they did was say, Okay, why don't you take charge of the, or maybe I did at the same time, charge of the hospital placement. So I really got back, I really got to the hospitals, you see.
Uh-huh.
Finally.
Yeah.
Finally. So I took on the that's what I did. I took on the responsibility for supervising, working with the supervisors of students who were placed in hospital and health settings. So I did that. And then I also did some teaching on health, you know, medical social work, finally. Finally! And then they said, no, I think I did the director of social work first, of the director of field placements first. But it was also a 12-month appointment. So then I said, I don't want to do this anymore. So then I just took on the medical social work bit, and that could be 9 months. So that's what I did.
And did you? So you finally got to the hospitals, and was that a positive experience?
They had wonderful people as trained expert social workers heading the social work students, and each hospital would maybe have one or two students.
And was it hospitals
here?
Just in Madison?
Madison.
Or okay.
Yeah, I might have had, yeah, that's
mm-hmm.
right. So I think that's what I was doing when I retired, but I can't remember that far back. But anyhow, yeah, and it was also during that time because of my experience. I mean, I'd always been interested in the world, but because of my experience in England, I really became internationally focused. And I started a group in the School of Social Work called Social Work Students for International Outreach.
That's still in existence, isn't it?
Well, it's been resurrected.
Oh, okay.
Susan Kidd Webster has resurrected it.
Uh-huh.
And I can't give her enough credit for that. And because I got so upset. Here we are on a huge international campus. We have an international foundation. We have the Department of International Studies, da-da-da-da-da. And where's social work? Nowhere. And so I was fighting this battle before I retired. And when I left, it just disappeared. And thank God for Susan for resurrecting it. I mean, the opportunities are there, you know, for students.
Mm-hmm.
And even on this campus. So I'm really thrilled, but I'm still disappointed because we do not have a single faculty person. We have never had a director of the social work program that has been willing to foster the international connections on this campus. And I still get upset about that.
Oh, yeah.
One of the answers that you hear is, I've got my own research, you know.
But you would think when a faculty position becomes vacant, they would take that into consideration.
I don't think they do. I can't, don't quote me.
Because, No,
I mean, I just never been able to understand it. Social work has traditionally been an international profession, especially post-Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem to have somehow, and there are many schools of social work who have extensive international programs.
Mm-hmm.
And we're supposed to be one of the best in the country, and we don't have any?
Yeah, that is odd.
So, anyhow.
Well, I know that you've brought us up to your retirement, and I know you've continued a lot of work and gone into new areas since your retirement, but before we go into that, I have to ask you, social work was it and is still a primarily a female profession?
I think there was a blip maybe during the Vietnam period where we were attracting more men.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say reliably whether we're predominantly female. My sense is probably, but I don't know.
Well, one of the questions that I ask women on campus, and you're in a unique position because you're in a field where it's primarily women, but not faculty, is it?
No, I don't think faculty.
Well, maybe you're not in that unique position. Describe the culture for women on the Madison campus as you saw it. Did it help or hinder people?
Oh, well, yeah, I was so involved, I didn't pay one bit of attention to that. And, you know, and we're talking about the 60s,
yeah,
before the women's liberation and all that and so forth. And I was raising my family, and I wanted to just make it. So I didn't experience any problems, and I don't remember my colleagues ever talking about it. One of the big issues, and it didn't have to do with male female, was the status of the non-tenured faculty.
Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
And I can't talk about it in terms of pay and so forth. And the School of Social Work actually did pretty good. We had this association or this group of non-tenured faculty who were teaching, and they made it. I mean, we had our own system, and we had a place to go where we commiserated with each other, or we decided we're going to present this case and so on. And then at some point, the university developed this clinical track, clinical whatever. You were identified as a clinical, or what did they call it? First it was clinical faculty. It was not the same as adjunct faculty. And what's the other name for it?
I can't help you.
Let me just think a minute. You can turn that off. So, you know, I mean, this is what morphed. These all morphed
staff
into academic staff. But what happened was in our department, and I presume this was true across, once you got the track established, then you had to meet certain criteria. And what was the criteria? Publishing. You know, and it got to the point within my department when they started that, I said, no way, goodbye. Oh, Norma, no, we don't want you to say goodbye. I said, I didn't get a PhD because they could look at my record. I had presented national conference papers. I had papers printed in this and that and the next thing. You know, but I wasn't doing research. And even when I was at the Weissman Center, they wouldn't consider me the same as other. I mean, I was different enough that I wasn't considered like anybody else. And so I got penalized for that. Well, one of the great things that's happened now with this interdisciplinary focus on campus is that people who are concerned about interdisciplinary matters and are working across disciplines will finally get noted for the fact that they're doing interdisciplinary stuff, and that's important, and you don't have to be doing your sole research focused on your own field in order to get recognition. I think it's one of the best things that's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told them I quit. And they said, we don't want you to quit. And I said, well, I'm not going to, you know, they even set up within so many years, you know, it was just like a tenure track.
Sure.
I said, I'm not going to do it. They said, okay, you can stay. And I did. But I did what I wanted to do. And I kept writing articles. I kept giving and so on and so forth. And that was, but I was doing it on my terms. And I guess that's part of me. I don't, I'll choose.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, talk about what you've been doing since you retired.
Oh, well, I got a whole new life.
I guess so.
Well, it was built on the foundation, actually, of always being interested in the world. And building on the experience in England and the fact that I like to travel. It's always been, and even going back to the idea that, oh yeah, I'd like to be an archaeologist or a anthropologist. I really didn't have any major plans for retirement. People used to say, what are your plans for retirement? I don't have a plan. Well, you better get a plan or you're going to be unhappy. And it wasn't like that. I just thought, well, when the time comes, I'll do what I feel like doing and want to do and so on. And I thought, okay, maybe I was a thespian. I used to be in college performances and so forth. And one of the things, I'd take this course on storytelling. You know, this guy is very famous. And I'll use my thespian practice and I'll dress up and I'll go to old age homes and group homes and that'd be one thing. I was also interested in architecture. So I could go and get involved in historic preservation. That's big in Madison. So I thought, well, those are two possibilities and that's enough, you know. But a friend of mine in London, one of the things that I did get involved in was I worked with University Extension and we designed little courses or we'd invite people to come. And when I was in London, I met this wonderful person who was teaching at London School, social work at London School of Economics, and I invited her here and she did stuff and we've been friends. So one day I get a note from her saying, Norma, I've got a grant from the Soros Foundation to develop a series of books that will be used for the first textbooks teaching that will teach Russian academics how to teach social policy. And one of the ones that I would like to do is, and she was doing focusing on social policy in terms of social work practice. She said, would you like to do a book on what American social workers do in health settings? And I mean, this was just before I retired. And I said, I wrote back and I said, I'm not going to write a book, number one. And number two, I will not write a book that just presents recent research findings. You know, because by the time you quote that research finding and you get it in the press and people read it, somebody else has already said, no, that's not right. Forget it. I'm not interested. But I said I'd be willing to do a concept book. You know, what are the concepts that guide social workers and give some illustrations? Okay, she said. So I started on that, and that was about 6 months before I retired. So one of my social work academic colleagues from Fort Collins, Colorado, and he and I had worked very closely together, and our heads were in the same place. And he was a member of a group called the Institute for Social Work Connection. Institute for Social Work Connection, something like that. And they were interested and had been working in the former Soviet Union to train people who were not called social workers. They were psychologists, but they were behavioral psychologists, you know, because that's the way things were in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But they represented the potential for developing human services, otherwise social work professional. And he said, they're having a conference in Moscow in the next 6 months or 8 months from now. How are you and I going to, he was going to help with the first and last chapter. He said, how are we going to write about this if neither of us has ever been there or met them? Whew! I said, great idea. So we took ourselves off to Moscow. And at that Moscow conference, I met the first, I met a group of very young, bright, wonderful professionals, psychologists, Belarus, Russia, and Ukraine. And they had just been hired by UNESCO to set up a network of community centers in Chernobyl-affected areas. Could you believe it? And of course, the main issues were health and radiation and so forth, so that just fit with me.
Sure.
So I went, talked with them and got to know them, and I went to the sessions they did and came back saying, yeah, I'm really interested in doing this book and I can see what some of the problems are. So we started on it, and the next year, I wasn't finished, fortunately, because the next year they had a conference in Kiev. And the same people, I met the same people. And I knew they were coming. So I said, one of my agenda items is to have some time with them to learn more about what they're doing and what they see as the future and so on. And after that, I came back. And there was a couple of friends, one from Bethesda, who was with me. And we came back and we said, we have to set up a project to support these people. And they have a mission that no other group of people in the world have ever had to deal with. It was, first of all, the horrendous Chernobyl disaster. And a few years later, the complete decline, breakup of the Soviet Union. So we came back, and Mabs and I said, well, let's talk with the international connections people and see if we could get a project going. Well, you know what happens when that takes place. People say, oh, Norma, Mabs, what a wonderful idea. Why don't you? So we started Friends of Chernobyl Center's focus. As a project of this larger international organization. But it became clear that our mission was so much more focused than theirs and so much more manageable. So we just agreed to separate, and we went off and founded Focus as a 501c3 non-governmental organization.
And you were you the original president?
Yeah.
And you've done this for how many years now?
Well, I think it was 94, 96. I think it was 94 the first time I went over, and 95 the second time I went over. And it was by the time the organization, what's the name of the damn thing? They got on board, and so it was about 1996 when we were actually a formalized entity.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was in 2001 or 2 where we got our 501c3 designation.
Okay.
So probably since 96 that we've been working on this.
Now, what kind of assistance do you offer? What do you do for them?
Well, that's. Let me just say, one of the things that we do for them is give them hope.
That's a lot.
in that situation, and with the history of that culture and with the devastation of Chernobyl, and we've been with them for a long time, and they know they can count on us, and we're there. Mm-hmm. So hope is, mm-hmm. if nothing else, you know, and that has something to do with, you know, the length of time and the way we relate to them. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, we've provided training for the staff. Mostly over there. We've brought people. We've managed to bring some of the people here for special kinds of events or training. We now have our own request for proposals strategy, where we set aside so much money and we say we have so much money, and we'll divide it between the centers if you pass our requirements and meet our expectations. Mm-hmm. So last year we gave $20,000, something like that.
And where does the money come from?
Well, that's a good question. The money comes from individual donations and fundraising events. And
so what kind of fundraising events have you had?
Well, last year we had a wonderful one. We had the Swiss bicyclists. Oh God. How many hours do you want to spend on?
No, tell me about it. The Swiss,
Duo, the man and woman, who bicycled from Switzerland to Ukraine.
Okay, so you... Oh.
So yeah, then we brought them, and then we brought them here.
Right.
And we had 80 some people come to the dinner at Monona Terrace. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the things that we did. We've tried to piggyback it when staff is coming here for other reasons, like the Circle of Love. The Bethel Lutheran Church has a project where they bring kids here for summer programs, and a staff person always comes with them. So we'll have a reception or a banquet, and they'll be the speakers. Mm-hmm. One time we had the deputy ambassador from Ukraine came, and we had a thing at Black Hawk. And right now... And we've sold greeting cards, and we've done also, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But what we're at the point where we need an executive director. I can't, and I told them, October, I'm done as president. Everything has gotten too. I mean, we know, and it's not any more complicated than it used to be. We just realize how complicated it is. We have more information to work on, and the things have changed. You know, it's been 20 years, so things now aren't like they were in 1994. The other thing that's changed is the technology. I mean, how to keep in touch and relate to each other. And it's just gotten, I don't want to run the organization anymore.
Yeah.
But I want to stay connected, and I have things that I can contribute that other people don't seem to be able to contribute. And mostly it's the networking. Mm-hmm. And thinking ahead and getting people involved and maintaining and learning what's going on over there. And that's different from making sure the minutes get done and the treasurer's report is circulated, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And somebody else can do that, you know. And other people are. I mean, I have to brag. We have a board now of 14 people, and there's not any, and they represent all disciplines. And they are all involved, and they're all doing something. They're not
coming to meetings and
that's it. And that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
great. So we actually received a certificate of appreciation from the U.S. Congress in 2000. I don't know, I have it hanging in the wall in there, 2005, probably, for the work, you know, recognizing the work we've done over there.
Well, you've received some awards.
And then I received the Millennium Volunteer Award from the State Department in 2002 or 3, something like that. And what am I forgetting? Those are the big ones. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then the National Association of Social Workers Award went to Focus.
I'd say that's a big one.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah, the foundation, NASW Foundation. Yeah.
What's the situation like over there now? 20 years later. 20 years later.
Yeah, it depends on who you talk to. The science part of this is debated by many people. One of the problems is that the International Atomic Energy Association is heavily involved, and they want to minimize the effects. And then you have people who've been victimized who want to maximize. And the thyroid cancer thing is pretty much, was thought to be total, pretty much settled, because it was going to be, the only people going to be affected are the kids who were at a very young age, who were close to the reactor, and the iodine, they don't use iodized salt over there.
Oh.
So the iodine that was released went right into these kids' thyroid. But now they're beginning to see that there were kids who were not so heavily exposed and who are now grown up who are now having thyroid cancer.
Mm.
So it's an ever-changing situation. One of the big things is that the UN came out right at, not too long after the accident, with a statement, and I could kill him for this, that the biggest health problem that resulting from the Chernobyl disaster is the feeling of victimization.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. I mean, I still get upset when I hear that, because, you know, if you went through what they went through, they were victimized.
Exactly.
And how do you expect people to recover from this in 3 to 5 years?
Well, and as you said, it's a generational problem. It's not just the people that were...
That's right. And so the science of this is very, very muddy. It's too complicated. But the latest UN report says, okay, people don't feel so victimized anymore, so now we're going to start on development. Start putting money into development. Because economically, all of these places are so economically depressed. Mm-hmm. I mean, who's going to build a factory in an area where you might have a very weak, physically weak manpower?
Right.
And you may be building a plant on ground that is contaminated. And you're not far from the Chernobyl plant, which is so dangerous, it could explode again anytime. And I mean, it not explode, but it could, the shelter could collapse, and under there is 200 tons of fissionable material. And if the building collapses and lets this all go into the air, it won't be an explosion. It'll just be this stuff floating through the air and coming down. Now, who's going to go into economic development? So.
Well, I hope they find somebody as good as you to replace you, because obviously they still need
help. Oh, there's still need. And I mean, what we need to do is find an experienced executive director who can get the financial base we need. I mean, we've been going on a shoestring and had been very creative in finding ways to in and out of these things. Mm-hmm. So it's, I'm anxious about it, yeah. But we're sending a study group over there March 7th, we leave. Myself and two new board members. And one of the new board members is David Utley. I don't know if you ever ran across him, but he used to work for the Wisconsin Foundation.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Oh, he's great. Oh, yeah. Boy, am I glad to have him on board.
Yeah, I know who he is.
And he's giving, he has had some international relationships, and he's really committed. He just came on our board. And he's really committed to being our development person. But he says,
great.
I'll be your development person, but I am not going out and asking people for money. I've done that, been there. You guys do that. But he can, again, the systems.
Yeah.
And he also can teach us, if we're going to go out and ask people for money, what do we need to know and how we need to do it.
Right.
So that's good. The other person is a woman from Chicago, Helena Traversa Young. Yeah. And she is Ukrainian, and her family is Ukrainian. She was born in Chicago and lives in Chicago. And she's been a high-powered attorney for Motorola, international attorney for Motorola and Abbott Laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
So the three of us are going on an 8-day fact-finding mission in March.
So where will you go?
We'll go to all the centers, because neither of them have been there. Most of our board has been there at least once,
mm-hmm.
but they haven't. And we also work with UNDP, the United Nations Development Program. So we'll be meeting with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a new rock star called Ruslana, who has started her own charity. And we've met with her once at the Ukrainian embassy in D.C. And we're trying to get an appointment with her staff. Oh, she is something. If I could show you a picture, you'd die. Yeah! Carpathian Mountains, folk rock.
Oh, my. Can we get her music here?
Yeah, I don't think so. And then the other person we're trying to get an appointment with is a staff member, the First Lady of Ukraine. Has started a charitable foundation for medical issues and supplies. And we're working with the School of Nursing here to get a shipment of hospital supplies to go over there, because one of the centers is located is partly responsible to a 400-bed pediatric regional hospital. So we're working on that.
Well, that all sounds good. I mean, that sounds optimistic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So it's just the leadership and the money. That's all, just the leadership and the money. Oh, yeah.
Well, do you have time to do anything else in retirement?
No.
No, that's why I walked away.
Yeah. My husband would like me to not be quite so involved and quite so busy. And it's time. I'm going to be 80, and I don't remember things as well as I used to, and I don't have the energy that I used to, and I feel the responsibility more than I used to. I mean, when you're young and you have responsibility, you just accept it and you go with it. But as you get older, it's not quite like that. So,
well, my final question has to do with your family, but I don't want to get to that. If there are things about your life or career or focus that you haven't said that you wanted to get on tape? You mentioned something earlier about Wisconsin Cares. You said you're still involved in.
Oh yeah, well that's a new organization, and it's Jack Westman, who's from the child psychiatry. And we initially were called the Wise Old Owls because we were all retired, but we're working to and Jack does most of the work. We're his eyes and ears and consultants and so forth. And it's just a small group of us, and we're working to restructure the Division of Family the State Division of Family Services.
Oh, is that all?
Well, and as I say, Jack is doing most of this, but they are restructuring.
Oh.
We've created, not just us, other people, created enough hullabaloo that they are going to restructure, but we want it renamed.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know what, because if you say the Division of Family Services, that means people are in trouble and have to come to us for a service. We're saying, no. You call it the Division of Family Resources.
Oh, I like that.
Then that means that people, if they need something to make it better or correct a situation, you come and you come to this place,
mm-hmm.
that will provide the resources, you know, whose responsibility is to provide the resources you need to make things better.
Right.
What's in a name?
Yeah, I see the difference.
Yeah. So, and I don't spend a lot of work on that. I go to a meeting once a month maybe, and do some thinking about it and reading about it. But I like that. I mean, because Jack Westman carries the burden. But he's got a multidisciplinary group from education, public policy, economics, state legislature, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're putting public health, and so again, it's that excitement of bringing these things together and talking to people from a different perspective and so on. But that's the only thing other than focus that I'm.
Well, have you got plans when you do have a little more time on your hands of things that you haven't done that you want to start? Or
not that I want to start. Nothing.
Okay.
I want to start.
Spend more time on that you can't
spend. Oh, well, I'd read more. I'd have more time for reading.
Mm-hmm.
And more time for friends. I mean, that has kind of gone, one of the things that's gone by the board. Not totally, but you know, I'd like to have more time just to socialize. And you're in the same position I am. You have friends that need help.
Right.
And you'd like to be there for them.
Sure.
And I can always, I mean, I could go to Global Health Colloquium. I mean, that I would get involved with.
Yeah.
And CRECA. I mean, I could go to school all day, every day. And I'd like to have time to do a little more of that.
Sure.
My motto is, once you stop learning, you're dead. And I don't ever anticipate, unless I'm on life support systems.
And even then,
I could be learning something.
Somebody could come in and read the New York Times.
Or you could learn what it's like to be hooked up,
yeah.
You know.
Right.
So that's it. And did you say you wanted something about my family?
Yes, talk about your family.
Well, Len has, and he probably told you, he has two daughters, and they have five grandkids. Four of them are now in college. One's on a PhD program. The other, two others are graduating from university this spring. And one of them is trailing behind. He's 14. My two sons, one is in trouble right now because he was the publisher of a magazine for the building industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you read the papers, you know how bad that is.
Mm-hmm.
So he's under a lot of stress, and he doesn't have any children. His wife is in real estate, so And they live in Bethesda. But they're good.
Yeah.
When they'll weather the storm, okay. My other son is in Marinette, Wisconsin, and he's in radio advertising, and he's doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife is a special education teacher. And so
have,
we...
Do they have children?
They have two kids. One is in... this is the way it is for a lot of families. One's on the West Coast, one's on the East Coast.
No.
One on the West Coast is into, got a degree from here, and I forget whether his major was, I think, economics. But anyway, he's big time into internet advertising, and he's with the biggest company who's involved in internet advertising.
Oh, boy.
And he loves Santa Monica. He is, I guess, a Californian par excellence, the surf. Is the thing, you know. And he's doing very well. My other grandson is in Boston, and he works for a biotechnology firm, and he's a graphics. He does their graphics work for brochures and internet and that kind of thing. And he's thinking about whether he wants to get a further degree. And he just got engaged. To a social worker, and they're living together. So that's it, and that's all the family that I have.
All these careers that we never even heard of.
Oh, isn't that true? And you know, it's so funny because I can remember my aunt and my parents. Now, you know, I know you have a job. But what do you do?
Right.
They couldn't, you know, it was so far from anything they'd experienced. And now I find I say the same thing to my grandkids.
Right.
I understand what my sons are doing, but grandkids, that's a whole different world. Just terribly different world. Yeah.
Well, anything else before we turn the tape off? This has been an excellent interview, and I really appreciate it.
Well, I had fun doing it, and I have to tell you, that as a result of this interview, I went back and I looked through my last curriculum vitae, but I also had saved a few of the papers that I wrote during my master's degree days, and I am glad that I had the excuse to do
Good.
That. Yeah,
Good.
Really, it was. Quite amazing, and brought back many memories, but also a reminder that, years and years have come, but I'm still me,
mm-hmm.
You know, I'm where I want to be, and that's a wonderful feeling when you're almost 80 years old.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Okay. All right. You didn't ask me about my married life now.
Well, please tell me about your married life now.
Well, I think that my life with the land is more than, you know, is given me more than I ever hoped for. We've had a great life together. We have a lot of mutual interests in music, the theater. He reads more than I have time to read for, but we're both internationalists. I've actually recently joined the Madison Foreign Relations Committee chapter and enjoy that, so we have our international interests. We'd like to travel, so we have our travel interests. And
is there some place you've been where you want to go back, not for work but for pleasure?
Well, we go back to London a lot, and Len's a big city guy, you know, and every so often, he was raised in New York, and every 5 years he's got to go and stand on the avenue in America and look up at the high building. So we go back there, and we go to London. I it doesn't matter to me. I can go anywhere and watch the people and think about their life. There's no place I wouldn't go. The only thing is, he promised if I married him, he'd take me to Machu Picchu. But he hasn't done it.
Well.
But we probably can't. I may have to go without him. He can't stand the high altitude now. But our honeymoon, we were in England, and we went to West Germany, and we went to, I can't get my geography right, and we were in India, we were in Nepal, we were in the islands, and then off to Australia. That was our honeymoon.
So this was this halfway around the world trip?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Len had a teaching opportunity in Australia. What's the one on the big one on the west coast?
Western Australia, Perth.
Perth, yeah. And so we lived there,
mm-hmm,
for a month, and getting from England to there and taking our time. You know, and we were just been married. We had been married several months, but that was it, and that was a wonderful trip, and so.
So life is good.
Life is terrific, all the way around.
Ready to stop? Well, thanks again.
Yeah.